And now, Indian touring and quantitative easing. What does it mean to quantitatively ease as the road to economic recovery? And why is the Fed doing it now? The Federal Reserve announced last week that it would buy up to $600 billion in long-term treasuries over the next 8 months in an attempt to stimulate the economy. To explain what that actually means and why they're doing it now is Robin Farzad, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. We'll also be joined in a minute by Meera Kamdar, associate fellow at the Asia Society and author of Planet India, The Turbulent Rise of the World's Largest Democracy and the Future of Our World. She will talk about the president's trip to India and what it signals for U.S.-India trade relations and jobs here, along with Robin. But hi, Robin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Why did they choose that name, quantitative easing?
Because it just sounds so much more professional than, guys, we're just out of options. We're going to pull something out of our hat. This is really just pulling money out of thin air with a strengthened Federal Reserve in the wake of the financial crisis. And the idea here being that they've Ben Bernanke has exploited he's used every arrow in his traditional quiver. He's taken short-term interest rates down to nothing. So what are you going to do then? You have moral suasion, you have quantitative easing, and maybe if this doesn't work, he'll switch to qualitative easing.
Is it buying treasuries, you're buying bonds, so in effect it's a loan to the government. Does this really mean that one part of the government is loaning money to another part?
Yeah, and it's somewhat off balance sheet in that the Federal Reserve is out there, you know, an incremental $600 billion. You could have fiscal or monetary stimulus. The Fed can take down rates to nothing. The Fed can print this money, literally print it, because the Fed does control the printing presses, and we're in no imminent threat of inflation, to go out there and ideally inflate assets, force people out of parking money in cash, and to ideally go out and buy equities or build a smokestack or two. And this is very much in theory. We haven't seen it work in practice yet.
I read that with this policy, some U.S. government bonds actually sold this month with a negative interest rate. Buyers are paying the government interest to take their bonds rather than the other way around. Is that true?
That's right, because the flip side of this is if this has a kind of an unintended consequence of overinflating the economy, we end up debasing the dollar. You want to be able to buy some sort of protection against rampant inflation, kind of 1970s style inflation. So you'll accept a negative yield in the interim in exchange for that security maybe soaring when and if we do have hyperinflation.
That brings up the mind-numbing question of whether to be more concerned about inflation from these moves by the Fed or the dreaded deflation, which makes everything worth less from year to year, so no reason to invest. And I guess people must be divided on that.
The Fed right now seems to be more terrified about deflation because it's never really had to deal with rampant deflation the way Japan has. And that's the terrifying specter. Japan has been at zero rates and quantitative easing 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 for the better part of two decades. And that's so much pushing on a string. The hope is that the United States situation is different enough that our institutions aren't as sick, as zombie-like as Japan's institutions were.
I heard conservative economics talk show host Larry Kudlow, who's on CNBC and WABC, say he's against quantitative easing because he thinks the dollar should be king. And I saw that liberal economics columnist Paul Krugman, in his column today in the New York Times, comes out for even more aggressive quantitative easing and worries Bernanke won't go far enough due to political pressures from other countries. Is this a liberal versus conservative thing?
No, it's really not. In fact, you find so much unanimity. The Chamber of Commerce traditionally has been pro-low rates, and the Federal Reserve should actively bring down the cost of borrowing. And people like Charlie Rangel have always gone out and inveighed against higher rates for low-income families. So there is more than a modicum of agreement on both poles.
But other countries are unhappy with this, right?
Right. Because once you make it prohibitive to be in the U.S. dollar and its value keeps falling, you have American investors, institutional assets, all manner of people pouring money to economies that can't handle the deluge, at least on a short-term basis. Germany's finance minister is calling this move clueless. Brazil's former finance minister, central banker, called this a currency war. You have Thailand, saying, you know, gosh, it's gratifying to see our currency go up 10 or 15% this year, but then we can't export anything. So why are you exporting your problems to us?
What's the argument for weakening the dollar? Rand Paul wrote a book called End the Fed, and will be on the committee that oversees the Fed.
That's right. I'd like to see the pyrotechnics that come out of that. When you weaken the dollar, the exporters that we do have in the United States, yes, there are still companies that make things and export them, will do far better. Their wares are much more attractive to the faster-growing Brazil, India, China-type economies.
But that's another mind-numbing question. Are we better off with a weak dollar so we can sell a lot of exports and create jobs that way, or with a strong dollar so that we can import consumer goods and sell, you know, buy them cheap?
Well, it all comes back to hurt you regardless. I mean, there's the Walmart effect, and China has certainly manipulated its currency. But we do have to pay for oil, which is, you know, when the dollar falls in power, or the price of oil seems to go up, other rare earths, certain commodities that we get from other countries invariably become more costly for us.
Robin Farzad, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and also joining us now, Meera Kamdar, associate fellow at the Asia Society and author of Planet India, The Turbulent Rise of the World's Largest Democracy and the Future of Our World. And, of course, President Obama is in India right now. Hi, Meera. Thanks for coming on.
Glad to be here, Brian.
Just to make the segue, does India care about this quantitative easing?
Well, I suppose if the dollar is cheap, it's going to have to, you know, it won't have to spend as much money to get all those military transport planes and things and those deals that Obama racked up while he was there.
And as Americans think, India, gee, that's the place that's taking all these call center jobs and engineering jobs and everything else. Here was some of President Obama's reaction to that in a speech he gave today to the Indian Parliament.
And together we can resist the protectionism that stifles growth and innovation. The United States remains and will continue to remain one of the most open economies in the world. And by opening markets and reducing barriers to foreign investment, India can realize its full economic potential as well.
So to talk about trade with India, it's confusing for the American public, isn't it?
Well, it's even a little confusing just from what he said, because in fact, in that clip that we just heard, there was a message to India to please continue to open up their markets more for U.S. investors. You have big box retail, Kmart, Walmart that would like to go in and that can't yet, and things like that. And so there was actually a message in that clip to the Indian government to open their markets more to let U.S. companies in.
All right. Indian American listeners, what do you think about President Obama's trip to India? Are you following it? Is it important for either country? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Hema in East Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hi there. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to say I think that the Indian media, from what I've read, seems slightly critical to Obama, and I think that isn't such a good thing because he has shown a sincerity in extending his hand towards the Indian people, you know, starting with his celebration of Diwali last year at the White House, and also the fact that he stayed in Mumbai at the hotel where they had the terrorist attacks. And he, you know, although he is forced to sort of maybe try to toughen regulations on, you know, Indian industries trying to establish a foothold here at the expense of the local economy, people in India should realize that, you know, India and the U.S. have a lot of things in common. And I'm hopeful that his recommendation of India in the U.N. Security Council will help a lot, you know.
Hema, thank you very much. And Biba in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. It's so great to be on your show. I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you.
And I've lived in the United States now for 11 years, and I became a citizen 3 years ago, just before the presidential elections. And it's amazing to see the two great democracies coming together in partnership, whether it's defense or commerce. And I hope this continues because, you know, India is, you know, the same principles as in America, and the license Raj is getting over there. And I can see from both perspectives, and it is, I think it's very positive. But what disturbed me was this morning when Scott Horsley said that India is jealous of Pakistan. And that really hit a nerve because I think, you know, it's like saying South Korea is jealous of North Korea because there's really no comparison. Indian economy, education, an open democracy, freedom of press, I'd rather live in India than in Pakistan today.
But I guess some Indians are concerned that if President Obama is trying to curry favor with Pakistan for security reasons, that that might in some way hurt India's security vis-a-vis Pakistan and potential terrorism.
Exactly. I agree with that. But it's not concern for jealousy. It's more of, being frustrated with Pakistan's Secret Service supporting their terrorist activities. Mm-hmm. And they don't come out. They're not frank about what's been happening over there. And it's the same thing what Pakistan is doing in Afghanistan, you know. So a New York Times columnist write about it. But I don't think India is jealous
it's
of
not
Pakistan.
Jealousy.
No way.
Okay, Biba, thank you very much. Indian Americans, 212-433, WNYC, 433-9692. Robin Farzad, is it a win-win proposition, or is this just an opinion question when President Obama goes over there and tries to strike these trade deals with India? So-called free trade is so unpopular right now, I think, among both Democrats and Republicans.
True, but I think there is a more important consideration, and not to diminish the role of the Indians in this, but the United States is, right now, is chiefly concerned with China as a currency manipulator. And there's very little efficacy with sending Barack Obama or even the Treasury Secretary or Hillary Clinton over to China. So if you try to curry favor with the Indians, you know, pun intended again, You are playing that they call it the game of Chindia right now, the race between China and India. And a lot of people in that part of the world look at it as a zero-sum game. And if you show that the United States is disproportionately engaging with India and showing that it's possible there and that we can actually go there and have a cogent discussion and conversation and shake hands, and it tweaks China as well.
At the same time, the U.S. has been accused by India of being protectionist after making it more expensive to hire skilled workers on H-1B visas over here. Some states have banned outsourcing for government business to protect U.S. jobs. They hear the calls in the call centers and things like that. Meera Kamdar, do you think the United States can learn anything from India right now in terms of economic growth? They're still growing at more than 8% a year, but is that just because they're starting from such overwhelming poverty?
Well, yeah, in part. I mean, look at the wage differential, which is, of course, one of the big reasons for outsourcing. I mean, if a company like IBM, which has outsourced so many jobs to India, can hire a competent engineer for $6,000 US a year versus $10,000 US a month, you know, there's a lot of incentive to do that. The argument that the Indians are making is that Indian companies, which have very, very aggressively investing overseas, have invested $26 billion in the United States over the five-year period, say 2004 to 2009, and created 55,000 jobs in this country. So the argument from the Indian side is, hey, come and invest here. That's going to help create jobs back in the U.S. Plus, open up your market so we can invest there, and we'll come in and create jobs in the U.S. Having said that, you know, when you break down the $10 billion in deals that Obama did when he was there and the 50,000 jobs that have been headlining, $4 billion of that and 22,000 of those jobs is one single contract to Boeing for military transport planes. And in fact, most of the contracts are for military sales.
Jerome in Fanwood, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Brian, good morning. It's always nice being on your show.
Thank you.
I just want to say a few things. I'm an Indian American. I've lived here over 20 years, and I care a lot about Obama's visit to India. Indians care about the following three things. Number one is their economy and outsourcing to India. Anybody who says anything against it or is against it, it gets people's hackles up. Number two, India cares very much about being a member of the Security Council, a permanent member. And I'll tell you why. India is the world's largest democracy, second largest in terms of population, 11th largest in terms of economy, and fourth largest simply in terms of purchasing power. Most Indians can't imagine how France and UK can still sustain their positions there, and a country like India can't.
Is it for status or to actually accomplish something on the Security Council or avoid something?
I think for now it's probably more for status. But eventually it wants its rightful say in what happens in the world. And the third point why I think Indians care about Obama's visit is they want to see that the mess that's left behind in Pakistan and Afghanistan doesn't move over to India.
Mm-hmm. Jerome, thank you so much. And Raghu in Middle Village, you're on WNYC in Queens. Hi.
Hi, thank you, sir, for accepting the call. I have got one point. It's a more symbolic visit because America has given $2 billion arms aid to Pakistan. For that, India may have to buy $3 billion arms to counter that arms. So this would be unproductive on part of India. And if really America wants, it must give an economic aid to Pakistan.
Roger, thank you. I get the point. I have to go because we're running out of time. But Mira, is it a U.S.-fueled arms race? We're selling arms to Pakistan on the one hand. Now we're selling arms to India on the other?
Well, I mean, the U.S. is happy to sell arms anywhere it can. We just had a huge deal with Saudi Arabia, for example.
And we sell to Israel. So destabilizing the whole region?
I'm not sure. I mean, to make the link to destabilizing, certainly people who warn against an arms race would say yes. Other people would say, look, we have to, help Pakistan be a credible partner with us in the war on terror. That also could be criticized. And India is looking to assert itself on the global stage as a major power, and part of that assertion it is buying in terms of upgrading its military capability in a very big way.
So in our last minute, I wonder how much the two of you see the rise of the Indian middle class threatening the American middle class because of the lower wages there, and if there's anything the United States can or should do about it. Robin, very briefly.
Okay, let's not immediately think that India is suddenly the cat's meow. It's arrived there. It's a country with a tremendous amount of potential, but tremendous obstacles. Infrastructure that's rickety, that needs sewage treatment plant the country over. India is going to need the United States and vice versa for these mutual demands. So let's not look at it so much as a zero sum. You know, they win, we lose.
But, Mira, all those workers in India willing to do the same work that was being done here for much less money.
Well, you know, that's true. I mean, I agree that we can't look at it as a zero-sum game. But it's also true that we're looking at a major seismic shift, globally speaking, of labor from the advanced economies of Europe and the United States, where wages have been, at least since in the post-war era, high and higher, to these emerging countries where wages are much, much lower. And a lot of those jobs just aren't going to be coming back. So the other question is, what do we do to replace them with other forms of employment? Do we transition to green technologies? What do we do to keep a flow of well-paying jobs and to maintain the strong middle classes that have been the strength of the advanced economies in the post-war
era? You get your
era.
Kids a math tutor. That's what you do.
Mira Kamdar from the Asia Society, author of Planet India. Robin Farzad, who had a good enough math tutor that he is senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you both,
Brian.
Very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.